Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And today I am joined by Claire Throssell. Welcome, Claire. It is really lovely.
Hi.
So for anybody who doesn't know Claire, Claire has been campaigning for, about 10 years now, Claire, is it?
10 years, yep.
To get the presumption of contact removed. And of course, she has successfully done that. So if anybody who thinks that it's other people who have achieved that, it is not, it is Claire. And there's lots of other people trying to take the credit, unfortunately, for work that they've not done. So Claire, would you like to, Claire's just going to, it's important that Claire shares her story to help other people, really. It's, you know, when survivors share their story, it is very much to help other people see the signs early. So, because pre-warned, when you're pre-warned, you can take action. And a lot of the signs are so, so subtle, aren't they, Claire?
They are, and it's only us that live with that person that see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can shout it from the rooftops, but if people aren't willing to A, understand, B, listen, and C, take action, then the situation just escalates. And perpetrators end up doing exactly what they want to do, yeah. Which is to punish in the worst way possible. I have to live with the fact that Jack and Paul only died because of me, because he wanted to punish me, and the court allowed that to happen.
Yeah, yeah. But you already knew it was a risk to the children anyway, didn't you? Whereas in there's other cases where the perpetrator may not necessarily present as a risk to direct risk to the children, but unfortunately, when they completely lose control, they become so blinded by hatred and rage and spite towards the person that they see as the you're the cause for this, so they want that revenge and to punish that person so much that they go for what means the most to them. And even if they do genuinely love the children, that love does not outweigh the desire to punish the other person, unfortunately. And if it means removing permanently the one thing that means the most to them, they are willing to do it.
Yeah, and perpetrators have no limits.
No.
To the cruelty. Perpetrators have a huge sense of entitlement. Well, this has been done to me, so I'm going to do this to you, and I'm going to have the last word. And that is really the crux of it. They want the last word. They want the last action. They want the last punishment. And equally, they don't want to be around to take responsibility afterwards either.
No.
So they take their own life as well.
Yeah. Exactly, and that's where that's categorized as last resort thinking. When we are risk evaluating, we look at we're always we're at, all what's always in my mind is revenge motive and last resort thinking. And unfortunately, when there are children involved, and this is where we have a problem with the whole risk evaluation process, we have so many, if there's been police involvement, for example, or any social services involvement, that potentially a that the adult victim and the children may have been categorized as a medium, some even low risk. And when there is child conflict issues and there is they're like a dog with a bone with the ongoing behaviors that they want to cause ongoing distress. It doesn't matter if there's been no strangulation or any threats to kill or physical violence or any sexual abuse related offences. Even if those things are absent, if the coercive control is repetitive and even after, and the lengths that they are going to is are quite severe. I mean, for example, my ex tried to get me done for he had me under investigation with false allegations of fraud, and he pre-warned me. He pre-warned me before, if precise words to be were, if you either do as you're told or what succumbs worse than having cancer. I didn't know what he meant. I didn't know what he meant, but I said to him, whatever you have planned, you think about our daughter. And he said, she's collateral damage to punish you, but you can make it all go away. And I'd say I know I didn't know what he meant, but it sent a message of such intense fear that that's when I crumbled and I called 999 under the pressure. But what I was literally caught off guard when I got a formal letter to say that I was under formal investigation with Office of Public Guardian with allegations of fraud. I say formal investigation. Fortunately, it didn't go anywhere. However, so yeah, so you have to take every single indirect threat very, very, very seriously. So it always, when there's any child conflict issues that's ongoing and it's repetitive and they are going to extreme lengths in the family court arena, we always have to bear in mind there's a possibility of revenge motive and last resort thinking. Because if they lose and they don't get their own way, and it could be like in Claire's case, where, because he didn't have control completely removed, he was given an element of control, which is why this happened. He didn't have enough control. He didn't have the level of control he wanted.
Yeah, and even in the family court, which was a barbaric and humiliating place to be, he was displaying his traits, his tactics. Even with a barrister, even with a solicitor present and a judge, he hurled insults across that courtroom. He showed aggression. He went for me outside the courtroom door.
Did he?
And yet, the judge, sorry, I've got a tickle in my throat. Even though the judge saw this and knew that he'd gone for me outside the court door, she still issued contact. So the mask had dropped.
I would say there was an element of bias in there as well. For her to observe and witness that, there's been an element of bias that's come in. This is more than a lack of knowledge and understanding and ignorance to some extent. This was bias.
Yeah, and his barrister said to him outside the door, "You're not helping yourself." Then That's the whole point. He couldn't help himself because that was the level he'd already been pushed to.
Yeah.
And it was on clear display in that courtroom, and it was ignored.
I mean, like in that case, Claire, in a case like that, it's, it is, that is just clear neglect and complacency. It's another classic case of Sara Sharif. They've allowed a child into that environment that they physically observed themselves.
Yeah, and throughout that whole process, not me, not Jack, not Paul, none of us were seen, heard, believed, supported, or protected. And throughout the whole process, his voice was the loudest. Always was. And again, that warning sign was not taken, was not acted on. To actually say that my case is rare is not good enough. And the fact that they said they couldn't predict harm is just outrageous because it's about preventing harm, not predicting harm. I told them that he was capable of killing them. I knew I was the one that lived with him. We saw his eyes when this red mist came down. We saw the lack of control, the always pushing the boundaries, always crossing that line. We can all cross that line and hurt somebody, but we don't. We take a step back. We choose to not say those words that we can never take back. But he had to throw it every time. He had to have the last word, go that little bit further to hurt and wound, use physical anger, use physical strength, intimidate. We live with that. And all of that was minimized or ignored by a court that should know better.
I think the problem is as well is that they like I was said before, they're always waiting for crisis. But in your case, he had already shown them the person that he was. And if he
Couldn't
sh
hide it.
and it's like we it's like we what we say when we say to people who are living with a perpetrator. Once they're once they their behavior shifts, they have shown you who they are. Believe them. Believe them.
That last incident, that Easter, when he went to punch Jack. And I took the punch on my arm and was spun down the stairs with the force of it. He stood at the top of the stairs and said, "Look what you made me do."
We're just going to break for a short interval, so stay tuned and then we'll continue this very important conversation.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise, elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
He said that to you, or he said it to Jack?
No, he said it to me at the bottom of the stairs. He stood at the top of the stairs and said to me, "Look what you made me do."
And that's common. That's common. You're responsible for my reaction.
But this time it was one too far, because I'd already been reduced to nothing. Feeling like a piece of dirt underneath, not just his shoe, but whole world's shoe. And that shifted in my head. And I knew the boys could not go on watching this any further. That they knew this was wrong. They were devastated. They were holding on to me on the floor. And something broke inside of me. And that's never been fixed, not even now. There's always that sense of imposter syndrome. There's always that sense of, who am I to challenge these people? There's always a sense of never being good enough. Because the abuse doesn't stay with the abuser, stays with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Add that to the guilt of not feeling like you're a good enough parent. Add that to the guilt of you can't protect them, because the system takes over, interferes, and takes that responsibility in one way away, but in the other, you are then responsible solely for their safety on access visits. And it just tears you apart, just destroys you. You are trapped. I always call it, you're in a basin of water. And at first, it's just, you turn the tap and it's just a drip. But then the water starts getting faster and faster. And suddenly you're in this bowl and you're drowning in this water and you can't keep up with it. And it becomes a torrent and it's pouring over your head. And you're just stuck in there and swirling around in the middle of the bowl with no control, no ability to get out of this situation, and just drowning.
Yeah. And honestly, Claire, I can't even begin to imagine. I mean, obviously, everything else up to that point, I can obviously completely relate to. But receiving that news, I just cannot even begin to imagine what went through your mind, you know.
I knew it was him. I knew it was coming. You know, as a parent, your role is to protect your children, and you certainly don't send them into danger. You don't stand at the side of the road with your children and say, right, cross the road, but don't look left and right.
Yeah.
And yet judges and CAFCAS and social services are expecting us to hand our children over to dangerous situations, dangerous people every week, because they say you should.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've got this big stick of, if you don't do what's on this court order, you'll get arrested, we'll give custody to the actual unsafe person. And I defy any judge to not feel something when you've got your children literally physically holding onto you, shaking, crying, and saying they don't want to go somewhere. And you know why they're doing that.
Yeah.
They're spraying themselves with your perfume to feel safe because they want a part of you with them as they face this onslaught every time they go to see this parent who's punishing them because they don't want to see that parent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paul told the Kafkas officer that his dad made him eat peas at the kitchen table until he was sick. But Jack never got an interview and he never got to say that he was also sat at that table and it made him cry watching his brother having to eat peas until he was sick and be called a crybaby. The only reaction Kafkas had to that and the judge was to say no visits overnight or at mealtimes. But however, you can still go in between. You manage the risk. You give a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old a phone with a code on it for if they're in danger. And off you go. And that is all they did to protect Jack and Paul.
Well, the phone didn't save them that day, did it?
No, because he just took them away. And when a Kafkas officer got barricaded in her office and still let contact go ahead, if she felt unsafe, how did she think a 12 and 9-year-old felt?
So she got barricaded in her office.
Yeah, told both Kafkas and social services to not see him on their own because when he heard something he didn't like or the conversation went away that was saying things that weren't going his way, he would get aggressive. When she tried to end that interview with him, not only did she ignore me and go in there on her own, he stopped her from leaving the room when she ended that interview early. He said, stopped in front of the door and said, you're not going anywhere.
So, and they still continued to recommend that he had some degree of contact?
Yes.
Wow.
And it was after that meeting, that night, 2 hours later, he was caught on CCTV footage buying 5 cans of petrol. But she was never interviewed as an accessory to murder.
Well, and this is the problem, Claire, is that there's no accountability when they get it wrong. If they and I genuinely think that if there's such blatant risk indicators that are actually, I mean, Christy may as well have been walking around with a red flag, saying, "I'm a problem, I'm a problem, I'm a problem. I'm letting you all know, I'm a problem." If they then make the wrong decision and a fatality happens, I think it should be dealt with the same way corporate manslaughter is, not manslaughter is, because it has been your decision during working hours that has led to this outcome. Now, all right, when it's invisible risk, we can't hold you accountable. Okay, because even the most robust, trained and skilled individual can misread invisible signs, invisible risk. But when there is when the writing has been on the wall the whole time, and you decide as a professional, well, we'll wing it. Because and what it boils down to a lot of the time is paperwork. It requires more work for them to prove something and to present a case like that than it does to say, no problem. That's easier. So in those cases, I think if it's very evident that you've taken a shortcut And it's led to a lost life. It needs to be dealt with the same way corporate manslaughter is. And if it is dealt with like that, you watch them be more thorough. You watch them because it goes back to the same thing as what we were discussing before. If the consequence represents a greater pain than the wound they're trying to soothe, things change magically. So
Yeah.
that's the only way, really, that we are going to remove bias elements as well, and shortcuts being taken that are leading to lost lives, is if they realize, well, if I don't look at this objectively and impartially and look at the facts and the facts alone, that and it backfires, it's going to be on me. They will change then. They will. But whilst there's no consequences, what does it matter to them? Okay, they may get dragged into the office and say, "Oh, you naughty, naughty, you did a bad job." But that's as far as it goes. That's as far as it goes.
I was never told if those Kafka's officers were actually still employed. I never had a full apology. I never had any acceptance that they had done something wrong. The only person who took accountability was me because I failed to protect my children, and I own that, and also the fact that they only died because he wanted the ultimate punishment. But what's saddest is the fact that a 12-year-old boy died believing he'd saved the life of his younger brother because I never told him differently. On that night, in that fire, when Paul fell, overcome by smoke, Jack went back for his brother. He gave him his hand, he gave him his strength. He pulled him to the edge of the attic and tried to save his life. Even though he was already dying at that point, he tried to tell as many people in that property what had happened. The fact that he was still trying to let the whole world know what had happened. My boy was thinking about everybody else apart from himself. And the fact that courts were involved, Kafka was involved, but he was there for his 9-year-old brother, but nobody was there for him.
No.
I only held them both as they died. I made them both a promise that no other child should have to be murdered at the hands of somebody who should love them and protect them, not betray them, hurt them, and ultimately take their lives. Not one agency has taken responsibility for this, only me. The judge is still sitting on the bench, is still sitting in family cases. And is still making unsafe decisions on children's lives. If presumption had not been introduced early in 2014, I don't doubt that Jack and Paul would still be alive today. Presumption has no place in a court of law, never has, never should have, never will. And like you say, it's not up to professionals to presume that the worst will never happen. That they can presume that a person is not capable of taking somebody else's life. That a person can presume that even though this person is displaying ultimate aggression, ultimate lack of control, ultimate rage, they're going to grant contact just because a clause in a Children's Act that was written to protect children. Say so.
We're just going to break for a short interval, so stay tuned and then we'll continue this very important conversation.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Risk is not easy to evaluate the best of times. And we need people with skills to be able to, with the skill to be able to evaluate that. I mean, I've even had nurses, a nurse that I spoke to in the community, and she didn't even realize that you needed training to do a DASH risk assessment. And I'm like, could you go out and do nursing without having done any training?
No.
Well, evaluating risk is no different to skill. It's not something that you're just born with. It's not something you just naturally have an ability to do. It is, there's so many moving parts to evaluating risk. It is a skill in itself. Fortunately, the people within the family court arena, they are well out of their depth for high risk cases. And in my opinion, I don't even think these cases should be handled at family court level. I don't think they should be. They haven't got the skills and they haven't got the resources to be able to manage cases like this. This needs to be dealt with at police level. And certainly when there's a open investigation with the police, that instantly should remove or suspend any contact until they've completed their investigations, in my opinion. Because by definition, if there's an open investigation, it already meets the threshold for family court to remove the presumption of contact.
Yep, and add into that the post-separation abuse. Sending threatening messages to me, sending awful messages to my family. My sister was dying of terminal cancer. He sent her messages. He slashed my tyres. He stalked.
There was ongoing stalking offences as well.
He followed me everywhere. And none of that, which was clear evidence of what was coming, was taken into consideration. They didn't even do a DASH assessment, risk assessment.
Yeah.
They ordered a Section 7 report, so they already admitted that there's domestic abuse involved.
Mm.
But even though the Section 7 had not even been started, contact was granted.
Mm.
Unsupervised contact was granted. I was minimised, the boys was ignored. And the only time Jack's voice was heard, because he never got an interview with Kafkas, was on that landing when he said, my dad did this and he did it on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said that to as many people as he could, not just in the property, but in the hospital, to make sure everybody knew what he'd done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that bravery has to be recognised. And that's why I started my campaigning all those years ago, because that courage, that love, that determination was never a child A. I was Jack. And the very fact that Kafkas ignored my warnings, and you could say put their own member of staff in danger by not putting safeguarding in place for them. I tried to keep everybody safe, and in the end, I kept nobody safe, especially not Jack and Paul. And that stings, and that will never go away.
But that's not your fault though, Claire, that you were bound by rules and regulations set by the authorities, essentially, the powers that be, and they became an extension of the abuse that you'd attempted to leave and escape. So that's not your fault, Claire, honestly. Please don't blame yourself for that. And the boys, I know, will be incredibly proud of you. I'm incredibly proud of you, honestly. To fight on after experiencing this level of trauma and loss and grief is hard for anybody. But lo but losing your source, your reason for living as well, it's like I can't, and I can't put myself in your shoes, Claire, because unfortunately that's not happened to me, luckily. But everything else you went through, I can totally relate to, but even that alone, there's not many people that can keep going, and you honestly should be very, very proud of yourself. Because the easiest thing in the world was would have been for you to just give up. That would have been the easiest thing in the world, and you've not done that. You've not done it. You have battled on for the memory of those of your boys, and with the aim to help other people. And this campaign's just the start. This is just this. Like we were saying before, there's so much more work to be done. Gee whiz.
I think one of the saddest things is the fact that there's 68 children that have been murdered because Kafkas, because judges have not taken that realm out of their heads and thought that people are capable of doing the worst crimes possible. On those two dark nights, I held my boys the tightest I'd ever held them in my arms. And still lost them. But for many of those other children, they died alone. They died believing they weren't loved. They died in pain and fear. I held my boys in my arms and told them that I loved them. They left this world in love, and our last words to each other was of love. But out of 68 children, there's only Jack and Paul's names out there. And I had to fight 7 years for a government to finally name them. All the other children, they are the child A's and child B's. They are in files gathering dust in Whitehall. And five governments have just successfully done that because we can never name those children. And again and again and again, agencies have not looked outside the realms of possibility. And realized that these perpetrators are capable of murder.
They are. But the other problem is as well, Claire, is that it isn't just those numbers indicate the children who have directly lost their life at the hands of the perpetrator, as young people. But forcing a child to go and see a parent who they are telling you they do not feel safe with, even if they don't lose their life at the hands of that person, the psychological damage that is caused,
so never leaves them.
It doesn't. I mean, so when we talk, when we obviously we're talking about the root cause, well, this is part of the root cause. We have a duty to ensure that children grow up in a healthy, stable, and secure environment.
And that is their basic human rights.
Exactly, exactly. So, and that's, so, I mean, it's like, well, you're, we all, everybody likes to throw around the term inclusivity. Yeah, well, if we are being inclusive, the basic human right, like you said, is to feel emotionally safe. But actually what we're saying is that a child, so a child has a right to have a relationship with both parents. But even if that, even if that child, even if that child says they don't want to see that other parent, what we're actually saying is that the, is that both parents have a right to a relationship, even when the child is saying, I don't feel safe. That's what exactly what we're saying. So it goes back 100%. To that. It's an indirect version of the inclusivity thing, where obviously in the school ground, if you've got a child who is suffering with, you know, who has got diagnosed with ADHD or autism as an example, and they're displaying troubling behaviours that are harming other people, they will make excuses under the umbrella of inclusivity. Well, this is another form of that. Well, we're saying, well, okay, we can't identify direct risk. Okay, so it's not really, if we're going to say it's a case of both, a child has a right to a relationship with both parents. But when that child's saying, I don't want to see that other parent, what we're actually saying is that they have a right to a relationship with their child, even if their child says they don't want to see them. And, you know, it is very, very rare for a child to say that they don't want a relationship with a parent, with a caregiver. It's not impossible, because there are circumstances where it could be the abused, the perpetrating party that is. So, for example, I was always accused of growing up of siding with my perpetrating parent. And it wasn't that I was siding with my perpetrating parent. It was that I recognized that if I didn't, I was sort of letting him think that I was on his side for not only my safety, but for everybody else's safety, because I recognized that if I collaborated and ganged up, it would make it worse for them as well as myself. So when we think a child is being coached, or a child is saying they don't want to see another parent, we have to ask the question, what is behind it? Is there, because there's merit in it somewhere, but is it really the person who they are seemingly collaborating with that is the danger? Or is it the person that they are saying they don't want to see? And that's where they have to evaluate, they have to have the skill to evaluate that, because it's not black and white.
Yeah, there's the danger, because judges are strangers to these families, to these children, to us. They see snapshots of lives through CAFCAS and social services, and they make judgments on those snapshots, and those judgments are ending lives. It's not for a judge to take a snapshot of a life, not go into the details that's needed, and just presume, because it says so in law, that it's in the best interest of the child to see both parents.
Yeah, exactly.
There is not enough depth. There is not enough understanding, and there's not enough breadth to judges when they are handed these snapshots and they don't ask for the further details, don't ask the professional questions, have that curiosity.
Yeah.
Like you say, the big question is why? Why exactly. don't they want to see exactly. that parent?
Yeah. Because when I did go against him, I suffered the price. So and I there was yeah. So you know you know and you know you've got to children display survival responses and sometimes they will and they will go either way. You know, sometimes you know they can be more submissive, sometimes they can be more argumentative and challenging towards the perpetrating parents. But both are survival responses and both have the same root cause. You know, so we've got to ask, and this is it goes to another reason why I always say, you know, to be, leave labels off the table when we're certainly when we're dealing with children, because unfortunately, if you've got a child who already has been assessed as ADHD or autistic as an example, it can cause professionals to overlook the actual cause for their dysregulation and blame it all on their yeah. condition.
And there is so much noise around parental rights and a deafening silence around children's rights.
Mm.
And the rights of the child is to be kept safe, to be loved, and allowed to grow up in an environment that allows them to achieve everything that they need to do in life to become decent people for the future of this country. They are getting it wrong on so many levels, and these children, they are the future of this country.
Yeah.
And if they're not invested in, if they're not believed, if they're not supported, then what does the future of our country look like?
We've come to the end of today's episode, but tune in next week where we'll be joined by Claire once again, where we'll continue this very important conversation.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.